Trump riders. It was given to Scott Fairlam. And feds want an even stricter punishment for the guy known as the QAnon shaman. Imagine that. 2 years ago, I didn't imagine we would be talking about anybody that goes by the QAnon shaman, but we are. Feds are asking for an even longer sentence for the QAnon shaman, and we're going to talk about how these cases are going, how strict are the sentences, and more on today's bonus show. You can sign up at joinpacman.com. You can use the coupon code BETTER21 to get a discount off of our memberships. We will see you on the bonus show. And live coverage of the Kyle Rittenhouse trial also continues today on YouTube as well as on Facebook. We are 27 days from being back on Twitch, banned for 30. We'll be three down, 27 to go. So just Facebook and YouTube today for the.
This is Brad Yoder, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3 FM.
WRCT Pittsburgh, we won't respect you anymore.
Hey, this is Tom from the band Loose, and you are listening to 88.3 WRCT Pittsburgh.
O-U-R-C-T. Radio 900.
WRCT in sound from way out.
Yeah, yeah, what's up? This is Total Eclipse.
Word up, Rock Raider from Executioners.
Word up, chilling,
chilling
with
on
RCT.
WRCT, Pittsburgh.
Yeah, yeah, 88.3.
Check it out, all right?
Word up, real hip hop.
Yeah, thanks, man.
You don't even know it's a hip hop show.
Oh, we do. We do everything.
Hi, we are Microwaves, reminding you that the most important things in life are to crush your enemies,
to see them driven before you,
and to hear the lamentations of their women while listening to WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3.
It's been a long time since you've touched the hand and the heart of that special someone. You're not alone. This is WRCT Pittsburgh's Radio Automation Service. Stay tuned for more tracks from our radio and record library.
Things get brighter day by day when you listen to the Big W. Life is lighter in every way when you listen to the Big W. So laugh it up and let yourself go with King Size Radio, the Big WRCT Radio Carnegie Tech.
Ow! It's E. Dueto from the Love Dogs, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
WRCT, Pittsburgh. Yeah, that's where things like this go, right down the drain.
Yeah, well, this is Kimon and Molly, and you're listening to WRCT-FM. Keep it locked, Rust.
WRCT, Pittsburgh. We love monkeys.
Hey there, this is MC Honky, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
You're tuned to WRCT Pittsburgh's automated
from New York, Rock Raider.
Yeah, yeah, 1-2, Total Eclipse.
From Executioners, and we chilling on WRCT.
Word up, Pittsburgh representing 88.3 FM.
Check
on
it
your
out,
dial. Aight, peace.
We're the 1985, and whenever we're in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, we like to pick up 13-year-old runaways at the Greyhound station and listen to WRCT! Woo!
Hey, this is Danny Glover, and you're listening to 88.3 FM WRCT Pittsburgh.
Soul is next.
We don't actually have the legal documentation to back that up.
We'll give you total control over our lives. Everyone shuts the hell up.
We're Hydra! WRCT! Pittsburgh!
You're listening to WRCT, friends of the FCC. Good friends, good times, and eggnog.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Technoland? RCT Techno DJs in the house!
bring you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh, right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
From New York and Glasgow, this is Democracy Now!
I prescribe healthy air as a right for all children.
I prescribe the rich nations to make the biggest cuts in emissions.
To fund climate health adaptation projects.
To invest in reversal of the negative impacts.
To build resilience.
It is already.
And tackle health and social inequalities.
And stop investing in fossil fuels.
Climate change is a health emergency. And it is my ethical duty to speak about it.
We have a crisis.
As the United Nations Climate Summit enters its final day and negotiators scramble to arrive at a new agreement, the world's health workers are calling on governments to protect people from unimaginable health consequences. We'll speak with two of them in Glasgow, including Dr. Jenny Miller, head of the Global Climate and Health Alliance and the World Health Organization's Civil Society Working Group on Climate and Health. We'll also get an update on the climate activist People's Plenary at COP26 today, which was followed by a walkout. And 30 years ago today, Indonesian troops armed with U.S. M16s opened fire on thousands of unarmed East Timorese civilians, killing more than 270 of them.
I lost one sister and two brothers.
It was 10 days before I was to give birth. The army was shooting people, and they would die at our feet, but you couldn't stop to help them.
I know families that were totally wiped out.
Massacre, the story of East Timor. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Climate Countdown. At the UN Climate Summit in Glasgow, negotiators have backed away from including a call to phase out coal as well as fossil fuel subsidies in the latest draft agreement, which was released today, the final scheduled day of the two-week summit. An earlier draft called for, quote, phasing out of coal and subsidies for fossil fuels. The new draft calls for the phase out of, quote, unabated coal power and of inefficient subsidies for fossil fuels. The draft also called for wealthy nations to double the amount of money they give to developing countries to deal with the climate crisis. But during Thursday's high-level session, Ugandan climate activist Vanessa Nakate questioned such pledges from wealthy nations.
I have come here to tell you that we don't believe you. We don't believe that banks will suddenly put trillions of dollars on the table for climate action when rich countries have struggled since 2009 to raise $100 billion for the world's most vulnerable countries.
In a major development, the governments of Denmark and Costa Rica have launched the Beyond Oil and Gas Alliance, the first high-level diplomatic initiative to phase out fossil fuels. This is Costa Rican Environment Minister Andrea Meza.
It is also about acknowledging that every dollar that we invest in fossil fuel projects, it is one less dollar for renewables or for the conservation of nature.
We'll go to Glasgow to speak with people inside and outside the UN climate summit after headlines. President Biden and Chinese President Xi Jinping are preparing to hold a virtual summit Monday. This comes just days after the world's two largest economies announced a deal to work together to address the climate emergency. Tensions been rising between the two nuclear-armed nations for months over Taiwan and other issues. On Thursday, Xi Jinping warned against a new Cold War beginning in the region. Meanwhile, the Central Committee of the Chinese Communist Party has passed what's known as a historical resolution resolution elevating Xi Jinping's status as a leader. Similar resolutions were passed for just two former Chinese leaders, Mao Zedong and Deng Xiaoping. The National Institutes of Health is locked in a legal dispute with Moderna over patent rights to its COVID vaccine. The NIH says three government scientists played a major role in developing Moderna's vaccine, but their names were omitted from the patent application. Moderna, which also received $10 billion in government funding, is now fighting efforts to share ownership rights with the government. In Afghanistan, a blast at a mosque in eastern Nangarhar province has killed at least three people and injured over a dozen others, according to local sources, though the death toll has yet to be confirmed. The explosion is the latest attack during Friday prayers. No groups claimed responsibility for the blast. The Islamic State in Khorasan province, known as ISIS-K, has said it was behind two other recent attacks on mosques that killed over 120 people. Meanwhile, up to 5,000 Afghans have been fleeing into Iran every day for months as the humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan intensifies. The Norwegian Refugee Council estimates up to 300,000 Afghans have entered Iran since August, when the Taliban seized control of Kabul. The World Food Program has estimated 23 million Afghans face starvation as winter approaches. This comes as the UN Refugee Agency is estimating the total number of people forcibly displaced from their homes globally has risen to 84 million due to war, insecurity and the climate emergency. The UN says the most impacted countries have been Syria, Venezuela, Afghanistan, South Sudan and Burma. In related news, a top UN official in Belarus says the situation at the Belarusian-Polish border is catastrophic, as thousands of refugees and asylum seekers, many from the Middle East, are braving freezing cold temperatures with no adequate shelter, food or medical care as they attempt to cross into Poland to enter the European Union.
As you can see, the situation is very catastrophic. The next day, it will only get worse, I think. One needs to do something. We have already started providing humanitarian aid by the Red Cross. It is something we will continue doing for a few days. What we don't want to see is a camp forming here.
Poland has amassed troops on the border to block entry for the refugees. This comes as Polish and other European leaders are accusing Belarus of trying to destabilize its neighbors. At least eight refugees have died so far. On Thursday, the president of Belarus, Alexander Lukashenko, threatened to cut off natural gas supplies to Europe if the EU proceeds with plans to issue new sanctions against Belarus. In a sign of support for Belarus, Russia flew two nuclear-capable bomber planes over Belarus on Wednesday and Thursday. In news from Burma, a military court has sentenced the U.S. journalist Danny Fenster to 11 years in prison. He's been held in jail since May. About 30 other journalists also remain locked up by the military junta, which seized power in a coup in February. In Sudan, Army Chief General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan has been sworn in to head a new governing council after he led a coup 2 weeks ago to oust Sudan's civilian-led government. The new governing council includes no civilian members from the previous government. Protesters responded to the news by blocking roads and burning tires in the capital, Khartoum. In Mexico, indigenous communities are demanding the safe return of Irma Lindo Barrios, a Mixteca forest defender in the state of Oaxaca who's been missing for over 2 weeks. Lindo Barrios is a leading voice denouncing illegal logging in the region. In 2019, she filed a complaint against illegal loggers to local authorities. Police did nothing. Instead, loggers in the area reportedly hired an armed group to burn her house down, as well as the homes of other earth defenders in her community. She briefly fled, but ultimately returned. Galindo Barrios was last seen alive October 27th. Solidarity rallies have been held across the occupied West Bank and Gaza to show support for five hunger-striking Palestinians who've been imprisoned by Israel without charge under so-called administrative detention. One of the Palestinians has not eaten for 120 days and is reportedly in severe condition. A sixth prisoner ended his 113-day hunger strike Thursday after Israel agreed to release him within 3 months. In other news from the Middle East, the United States, Israel, Bahrain, and the United Arab Emirates are holding 5 days of joint military exercises for the first time in the Red Sea. This comes just a year after Bahrain and UAE normalized relations with Israel, which has floated the idea of forming a NATO-type alliance to target Iran. In Kenosha, Wisconsin, testimony has ended in the trial of Kyle Rittenhouse, the white teenage gunman who fatally shot two people and wounded a third during protests over the police shooting of Jacob Blake in 2020. Closing statements are set to begin on Monday. Meanwhile, in Georgia, the trial of the three white men who hunted down and shot dead Ahmaud Arbery took an unexpected twist Thursday when a defense attorney claimed the courtroom presence of high-profile black pastors sitting with the Arbery family could be, quote, intimidating for the jury, which is almost all white.
Obviously, there's only so many pastors they can have. And if their pastor's Al Sharpton right now, that's fine. But then that's it. We don't want any more black pastors coming in here. Or other, Jesse Jackson, whoever was in here earlier this week, sitting with the victim's family, trying to influence a jury in this case.
In a statement, the Reverend Al Sharpton said the attorney's comments, quote, underscore the disregard for the value of the human life lost and the grieving of a family in need of spiritual and community support, he said. In Los Angeles, Olympic gymnast and gold medalist Sunisa Lee was pepper sprayed in an anti-Asian attack. Lee says the attack took place as she and a group of friends, also of Asian descent, were waiting for an Uber when passengers in another car shouted racist slurs at them and one person pepper sprayed Lee on the arm. Attacks on Asian Americans skyrocketed since the start of the pandemic, with nearly 5,000 incidents reported in the first half of this year. 18-year-old Sunisa Lee is the first ever Hmong American to both participate in the Olympics and win a medal. A federal appeals court temporarily blocked the release of records of former President Trump's White House calls and activities related to the January 6th insurrection. House lawmakers are seeking the records as part of their sweeping investigation into Trump's attempt to overturn the 2020 election. Earlier today, ABC News released audio of Donald Trump defending his supporters who called for hanging his vice president, Mike Pence, on January 6th. He made the comment in an interview with Jonathan Carl.
You heard those chants. That was terrible. I mean, was, you know, the...
He could have. Well, the people were very angry.
They're saying, hang Mike
Because
Pence.
It's common sense, John. It's common sense that you're supposed to protect. How can you, if you know a vote is fraudulent, right?
Yeah.
How can you pass on a fraudulent vote to Congress?
This comes as House Democrats are threatening to seek criminal contempt charges against Trump's former chief of staff, Mark Meadows, if he refuses to testify today as part of the January 6th probe. In New York City, 3,000 graduate workers are on strike at Columbia University. The Union of Teaching and Research Assistants is demanding a fair wage, better health insurance, and proper mechanisms for addressing harassment and discrimination. The student workers say Columbia refuses to negotiate a fair contract, even as the school's assets increased by $3.3 billion over the past year. Columbia threatened to withhold pay and stipends from the striking workers. And British prison authorities have reversed course and have now granted permission to Julian Assange, the imprisoned founder of WikiLeaks, to marry his partner, Stella Morris. The couple had sued the British government after their initial attempt to marry was blocked. To see our interview with Stella Morris, the fiancé of Julian Assange, when she visited Glasgow, Scotland, the UN Climate Summit, go to democracynow.org. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Climate Countdown. We're broadcasting from New York and Glasgow. As this year's United Nations Climate Summit enters its final scheduled day, negotiators are scrambling to arrive at a new agreement. This comes as the world health leaders are calling on governments to match their climate commitments to limit global heating in order to protect people from what they call unimaginable health consequences. This week, the Global Climate and Health Alliance presented a letter to the president of COP26 and the president of next year's COP in Egypt, signed by 46 million health workers worldwide, who are part of a campaign calling for global climate action on health. These are some of the workers.
I have seen rising rates of heat exhaustion.
Depression.
Double the normal number of asthma exacerbations.
Heart disease, heart attacks, stroke.
Problems with kidneys, hearts, and lungs.
I've seen children die due to the air quality on our streets.
Vector-borne diseases, as well as children's diseases.
And the worsening of psychiatric illnesses.
Stress and anxiety of not knowing, is this flood going to come again?
When the Category 4 typhoon made its landfall, the hospital's basement flooded.
Heat waves close to 50 degrees.
The unprecedented droughts and locust infestations.
More frequent, longer, and hotter heat waves are making my patients sicker.
I prescribe healthy air as a right for all children.
I prescribe the rich nations to make the biggest cuts in emissions.
To fund climate health adaptation projects.
To invest in reversal of the negative impacts.
To build resilience.
It is already.
And tackle health and social inequalities.
And stop investing in fossil fuels.
Climate change
is a health emergency. And it is my ethical duty to speak about it.
We have a crisis.
This comes as a delegation of mothers from Brazil, Britain, India, Nigeria, Poland, and South Africa attended COP26 to deliver their own letter to the summit's president, signed by about 500 parent groups from 44 countries, calls for limits on air pollution. One of the parents, Rosamund Kissedebra, had a daughter, Ella, who died last year from a rare form of asthma and is the first person in Britain to have air pollution officially listed as her cause of death. An installation by artist Michael Pinsky at COP26 features giant pollution pods that mimic the air quality of the future in various cities to show the link between climate change and health. For more, we go inside the COP, inside the UN Climate Summit in Glasgow, to speak to two guests. Amit Singh is with us, medical student at University of East Anglia, COP26 National Working Group Chair for Students for Global Health. And Dr. Jenny Miller is with us, Executive Director of the Global Climate and Health Alliance, co-chair of the World Health Organization Civil Society Working Group on Climate and Health. She helped present the letter at COP26 from 46 million health workers. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Jenny Miller, let's begin with you. Talk about the connection between global heating, between the climate emergency and health.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Amy. It impacts, climate change impacts health in so many ways. You were speaking earlier about air pollution. The drivers of climate change are the same. Burning of fossil fuels also drive the air pollution that is killing 7 million people around the world every year. The heat waves, we're seeing heat waves around the world just this year. 500 people died from a heat wave in Western Canada. The extreme weather events that bring flooding have displaced tens of thousands of people with floods in Southeast Asia. We're also seeing the spread of infectious diseases. We're seeing malaria and dengue and Lyme disease spreading into new regions as a result of changing humidity, changing ecosystems, changing weather patterns. So the health impacts are they're growing, they're significant, they're touching every country in the world. And the most vulnerable countries are being hit the worst.
And talk about the letter that you, with a group of others, just delivered, representing tens of millions of health workers around the world.
Yeah, absolutely. So as we've seen these impacts on health increase around the world, the health community has really woken up and become very activated around this. Doctors and nurses are used to treating people when they come into the clinic, come into the hospital, but increasingly we're recognizing that we can't care for the patients and the communities that we serve if we don't step outside the clinic and address this driver of health impacts, which is climate change. So with this letter, organizations representing 46 million health professionals around the world came together around a letter articulating some of those health impacts that we were just talking about and really calling for the level of action that we need to see that we're not yet seeing from global leaders.
Can you talk about why going beyond 1.5 degrees Celsius, 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit, is extremely dangerous for people's health? And can you directly relate the issue of the climate emergency with the current and future pandemics and epidemics?
Yeah, absolutely. So we're now at about 1.1 to 1.2 degrees of warming over pre-industrial levels. And that we're already seeing these superstorms, heat waves, droughts, movement of infectious diseases, wildfires. That's what we're seeing at 1.1. 1.5 has been kind of identified as the limit beyond which we're really anticipating catastrophic impacts on people's health. And every tenth of a degree will make a huge difference in lives lost and health impacts. You know, the connection with pandemics, climate change is a threat multiplier. So when we have a pandemic, and we're also facing climate change issues, the ability to respond to that pandemic is impacted by the challenges of climate change as well. And one of the places that we've seen that in this round is there were communities that were already facing drought-driven undernutrition and hunger with the pandemic that impacted supply chains and ability of people to move around and do what they needed to do. Those communities were kind of really pushed to the brink of famine. So that's on the impact side. I think more generally, you know, human beings are putting pressure on our natural ecosystems, and we know that there are zoonotic diseases that transfer from wild animals to humans. The more pressure we put on those ecosystems, the harder it will be to prevent the next pandemic that may occur.
I want to bring Amit Singh into this conversation, a medical student at University of East Anglia, which has an incredible climate division at the university, COP26 National Working Group Chair for Students for Global Health. Can you talk about this COP happening in the midst of this global pandemic and how it's affected attendance at the COP when it comes to issues like vaccine equity? We started our first day by interviewing a leading climate activist, not at COP26, but in Mozambique, because she couldn't make it there.
Yes, definitely. So that is a huge issue that we're facing right now. The pandemic has meant that a lot of people who are in the global south, as in countries within Africa, within Latin America and other countries like that, they can't actually come to the UK, firstly due to vaccine access, as we've already mentioned, but also due to things such as finances and visa applications not being accepted on time. A lot of the delegates that I actually know within COP right now got their visas approved the day before they were meant to arrive as well. So some of them are preparing last minute, getting the funds ready last minute to actually represent their countries, represent their communities, to advocate for health for their communities in particular. And the pandemic has definitely played a huge, huge role in that. We've seen how the pandemic has also, you know, decreased health equity in general. Disparities between communities are prevailing more and more and more. Countries, again, in the global south are being impacted more in the sense that not only do they not have more vaccines, the vaccines that they actually need, countries in the global north are oftentimes hoarding them as well. So there is definitely a huge disparity there.
Can you talk, Amit Singh, about when ExxonMobil and other companies claim that when you raise these issues, you're playing the health card whenever healthcare is discussed at the COP? What does playing the health card mean?
Playing the health card means saving lives. We are playing the health card because the health card is the most important card to play. This is the only way to discuss climate change from the health community. We have to talk about how it's going to impact people and their health. The amount of people that are going to actually die, sadly, as a result of climate change. We're looking at 250,000 preventable deaths per year. So playing the health card is the most important card that we can play, as that's the desperation that we're facing right now. And Exxon and all these other companies don't want to recognize that. They want to belittle the most important aspect of this discussion, which is about saving lives, about saving people, and making sure that people live good quality lives, not just live lives that are disparaged and unhealthy, but lives that they actually deserve to lead as well.
Talk about medical students organizing around the world, Amit.
Yes, so medical students all around the world are actively working on climate change and health. We are seeing the impacts of climate change on our own patients already, you know, going into clinics and seeing how patients are being impacted by air pollution from heat stroke and so on. We're seeing that every single day. And not only is it hard to see and sad to see the resources being put to use in a situation where we could prevent these issues occurring, it's also sadly very traumatic for a lot of these medical students and doctors as well. So we're working as hard as we can all across the globe to call on health equity, to call on vaccine equity, to make sure the voices from those who are most impacted in particular are heard. Alongside that, we're focusing on making sure that there is an actual justice transition. We want to create change where our economic system is actually related to the health of our community. We want to create a well-being system, a Green New Deal which allows healthcare workers to actually play a clean role in our environment as well, making sure that we reduce actual diseases, but also working to make sure that we don't actually increase those emissions that a lot of people in the sustainable healthcare system have not actually been working on so far.
Let me go back to Jenny Miller. And if you could talk more specifically about diseases and how they relate to the climate catastrophe. For example, the World Health Organization reports over 250,000 additional people die each year. And you referred to some of this before. Malaria, diarrhea, heat stress caused by climate change. What is adaptation funding? How can this be dealt with?
Yeah, so, adaptation, so first of all, mitigation is critically important. We will not be able to adapt to climate change if we don't slow it down. Like, if climate change is unabated, we won't be able to adapt enough to keep up with it. But that said, we're already seeing the impacts widely now. And currently, there is not enough funding being put into adaptation, particularly funding that's been promised for years from wealthier countries to lower income countries to help them address the climate challenge. A significant proportion of that funding that has been made available has gone towards mitigation, not towards adaptation. The promised amounts have not been met. And in adaptation funding that is being leveraged, very little of it is going towards health and, strengthening health systems. So we need to see significantly more funding being allocated to adaptation. We need wealthy countries to meet the promises they've made and actually bring in more funding, because these kind of most impacted countries, the lower income countries, are really struggling to keep up with the health impacts that they're seeing, as well as the impacts on their health systems themselves.
Last year,
we would really like to see stronger funding.
We spoke to Sonia Shah last year, science investigative journalist, author of Pandemic, Tracking Contagion from Cholera to Ebola and Beyond. I asked her about the connection between the climate crisis and coronavirus.
The climate crisis is resulting in tens of thousands of wild species moving into new places. It's scrambling our migration patterns. And so that's going to contribute to this broader phenomenon of people and wildlife coming into new kinds of contact. We can see with, for example, deforestation, that when you cut down the trees where bats roost, for example, they don't just go away. They come and roost in your back gardens and your farms and your yards instead. And that allows people and bats to come into new kinds of contact. And the microbes that live in their bodies, which don't cause them any kind of disease, can spill over into human bodies. And that's how we turn animal microbes into these epidemic and pandemic-causing pathogens.
Jenny Miller, your final comment.
The outcomes for COP are still being negotiated. We want to see strong commitment to limiting warming to 1.5. We want to see strengthened funding for adaptation that's given to lower-income countries so they can have the resources they need to adapt. And we want to see follow-through on all of these commitments. It's critically important that we be taking action now.
And finally, Amit Singh, as you head back to your university and you continue your training as a doctor, can you talk about what you bring from this and your demands of this climate summit?
Yes. So firstly, I demand 1.5. Right now, the negotiations are working towards 2.4 degrees. As Jenny's already mentioned, this is just not sustainable and not healthy for our communities at all. Secondly, I demand that the countries that have broken the promise of 100 billion actually stick to that promise, increasing that promise, making sure that the countries that do not have the funding to actually act on this climate crisis can be supported. This funding must not be a loan, but it has to be a grant. It has to be something that they don't have to pay back, because this money was taken from them originally through impacts like colonialism and through capitalism as well. So when I go back to UBA, I'm going to bring this discussion to my local community as well. I'm going to talk to my university. I'm going to talk to my local doctors as well. We need to get the healthcare community together and act on this as a collective mobilization.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. Amit Singh, medical student at the University of East Anglia, COP26 National Working Group Chair for Students for Global Health, and Dr. Jenny Miller, Executive Director of Global Climate and Health Alliance, co-chair of the WHO, the World Health Organization, Civil Society Working Group on Climate and Health, speaking to us inside the COP. Next up, we go outside, because today there was a climate activist people's plenary in the COP26, followed by a walkout. Asad Rehman led that walkout. We'll talk to him outside. Speed is speedy, slow down time, gas station is running dry. Sweaty, sweaty, wonder. It's always summertime. It's all gone, but here we're gonna stay. Anyway, the concrete's all empty, so we're making a parade. It goes a left, nothing there. It goes a right, watch your step. It goes a left, don't look now. It goes a right, look straight ahead. With me by Sylvan Esso. This is Democracy Now! It's Climate Countdown. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue our coverage of the UN Climate Summit in Glasgow, Scotland, where negotiators have backed away from including a call to phase out coal as well as fossil fuel subsidies in the latest draft agreement, which was released today, the final scheduled day of the two-week summit. An earlier draft had called for, quote, phasing out of coal and subsidies for fossil fuels. Meanwhile, the new draft is calling for the phase out of unabated coal power and of inefficient subsidies for fossil fuels. One of the added words, unabated, means nations could continue using coal if they're able to catch large amounts of the carbon dioxide they emit, something that's been widely deemed controversial as the technology to fully capture greenhouse gases is still being developed. Indigenous leaders and climate justice activists have denounced the draft agreement as a failure and far weaker than what climate scientists say is crucial to do to contain global heating to 1.5 degrees Celsius or 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit above pre-industrial levels. Today, dozens of people took over the plenary hall inside COP26 to amplify their demands. A huge procession of global climate justice advocates then marched through the hallways of COP26 as they chanted power to the people and walked out of the venue where they met with other protesters. For more, we go outside the venue where we're joined by Asad Rehman, executive director of War on Want, lead spokesperson for the COP26 coalition, one of the organizers of today's People's Plenary, part of the walkout now. Asad Rehman, welcome back to Democracy Now! Describe where you are and what your response is to this latest draft of what will be the Glasgow Pact.
Well, our response to this, we should not call it a Glasgow Pact. We should call it the Glasgow Suicide Pact for the poorest in the world, because it does not keep us below the 1.5 degree guardrail. In fact, it heads us closer to 3 degrees. Governments turn their backs on the poorest and the most vulnerable in the world, unable to even meet the paltry 100 billion. They're ramming through so many loopholes that it makes a mockery of these climate negotiations. And that's why this morning, over 700 people from all the different civil society constituencies representing environmental organisations, women and gender, youth, trade unions, indigenous people, farmers and peasants came together in, and took over one of the main plenary halls where these deals are cooked up. And we issued our own People's Declaration calling on what we actually wanted to see outside in this COP. Countries to commit to their fair share of effort, strong binding targets with real zero by 2030, meeting the 100 billion, but actually recognising that we need trillions if we're going to have a real just transition that leaves no one behind, recognising that the reality of this climate crisis means that we need adaptation and loss and damage for the poorest and most vulnerable, and that rich countries need to take responsibility and liability for the damage that they're doing. We know that it's the polluters and big businesses who have helped draft some of these clauses. So this was our attempt as people drafting our declaration as a rallying call both from the inside and the outside.
So describe the people's plenary and the walkout, Asad.
So this morning, there are official UN constituencies which are recognised by the United Nations. And we're an integral part of these negotiations. We are the eyes and ears of global civil society. And what we found over these 2 weeks is that we've been locked out of those negotiations. We've been barred from the negotiating rooms. We're unable to even begin to see what is being negotiated, so-called in our name. And that drove in an unprecedented a moment of unity across really all of global, and these are not just climate justice organisations, mainstream organisations all coming together and saying we're absolutely fed up, we're absolutely frustrated by the slow pace of action, by the inaction, and by the way that the UK presidency has hosted this COP to silence our voices. And they issued we heard a speech after speech from each of the constituencies, and then a declaration which had been drafted by all the different constituencies was adopted by popular acclaim. People broke out into singing of power to the people, and led by the indigenous movement, we came out to meet a massive rally of people who from the outside were at the gates to welcome both the inside and outside together, and to declare that whilst they are calling for inaction, we're calling for justice. And our movement is getting stronger and stronger. We're uniting trade unions and indigenous women and students, young and old, and we're building the movement that is needed. We know that this change will only happen when we as ordinary people lead this change and force our governments to act in our interests.
Asad, we only have a few minutes, and I wanted to ask you about your meeting with Boris Johnson, the British Prime Minister.
Well, I met with Boris Johnson. We, as War Hunt, we gave a commitment to the movements of the people of the UK, saying that not only would we build a movement that is needed here in the UK, and we have built a powerful climate justice movement that put hundreds of thousands of people on the streets, but we'd take that voice and that message and their demands into the negotiations and into and making sure that the Prime Minister heard that. I set out that the UK is hypocritical, that it cannot be a climate leader when it's green-lighting more gas and oil licences in the North Sea, when it's turned its back on the poorest with the COVID vaccine apartheid, when it's cut its oversized development aid, but it's handing out billions and billions to fossil fuel subsidies. If the UK was a genuine leader here, it would be committing its fair share of action. The Prime Minister, of course, said, I'd love to see more action, as if somebody else is doing, is responsible and is able to do this action. He's the leader of this country. The Britain is one of the most polluting countries and historically, and has a responsibility to act. And in fact, when we started this summit, the Prime Minister said, we're at 1 minute to midnight. He doesn't act like we're at 1 minute to midnight. He acts like we've got years and years and years. And the reason why is because, of course, the first people on the front lines are not the people in the global north. They're the people of the global south. Once again, sacrificing people for profit.
Finally, Asad, the Green New Deal, the global Green New Deal, in this last minute, what would it look like?
Well, a radical global Green New Deal not only tackles the climate crisis and cuts our emissions fairly, but it actually also recognises we need to tackle global inequality and poverty. Half the world is locked into poverty at this moment in a world of abundant riches. We need to keep within planetary limits. We cannot build the transition in the global north with the same logic of extraction on the global south. We need to transform from an economy of extraction to a circular world, sharing equitably the world's resources and wealth. We also need to recognise that the realities of why these injustices are taking place are structural, and they've been hardwired into our economies. From slavery to colonialism to imperialism to neoliberalism, what we've seen is that the richest have grown wealthy on the backs of overwhelmingly the global south. We need to uproot those systems and create a fair and just world, one where everybody has a right to live with dignity and we live with harmony with our planet. We know what needs to be done. We've got the plans and policies. We know we need to transform our energy and food system. We need to guarantee people living wages, public services and social protection. We know all the things that we need. And now we need to build the power to it. And all around the world, over these last 2 weeks, what's been amazing has been the different iterations of people not just saying what's wrong, but saying this is the world and this is what we're going to fight and this is what we're going to create. Assad, and that's been the most uplifting thing about this summit.
Assad Rahman, I want to thank you for being with us. Executive Director of the War on Want, lead spokesperson for the COP26 coalition. He addressed the plenary earlier this week. Today, he was one of the leaders of the walkout of civil society. Next up, we go to massacre, the story of East Timor. 30 years ago today, Indonesian soldiers opened fire on unarmed East Timorese civilians, killing more than 270 people. Stay with us.
Will a child from the future knock on your door? Will she say, I'm a dead kid from 2044? Yeah. You don't seem to want your future anymore, but the future wants more life, not war. I am the X in extinction, you fools, your children's children from 2044.
I am the X. In Extinction by Reverend Billy and the Stop Shopping Choir. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. In East Timor today, the people, the nation, remembered what happened 30 years ago today. Yes, today is the 30th anniversary of the Santa Cruz Massacre in occupied East Timor. On November 12, 1991, Indonesian troops armed with US M16s fired on thousands of unarmed Timorese civilians gathered at the Santa Cruz Cemetery in Dili, the capital of East Timor. At least 270 Timorese were killed. The massacre was a turning point in Timor's struggle for self-determination after years of Indonesia's brutal occupation. At least a third of the population over that 17-year period was killed, 200,000 people from 1975 to 1999, when Indonesia in 75 illegally invaded East Timor. Journalist Alan Nairn and I witnessed and survived the massacre 30 years ago today. The Indonesian military beat us, fractured Alan's skull. We got out that day to report to the world about the massacre, to stop the killing. We did not succeed. But today we go back to that day 30 years ago as we feature an extended excerpt of the documentary Alan and I produced, Massacre, the Story of East Timor.
I lost one sister and two brothers.
It was 10 days before I was to give birth. The army was shooting people, and they would die at our feet, but you couldn't stop to help them.
I know families that were totally wiped out.
Two American newsmen badly beaten, Mr. Alan Lane and Ms. Amy Goodman.
The Indonesian army converged in two places.
Hundreds and hundreds of troops coming straight at the Timorese.
When they came, they opened fire on the people.
Well, we pride ourselves, and I think properly so, in standing up for human rights.
Military assistance programs expose the trainees to democratic ideas and humanitarian standards.
I'm very concerned about what's happened in East Timor. We have ignored it so far in ways that I think are unconscionable.
Massacre, the story of East Timor. I'm Amy Goodman.
Big countries with powerful military machines should not be permitted to invade, occupy, and brutalize their peaceful neighbors.
With these words, former Secretary of State James Baker explained why the United States was going to war against Iraq. Yet 16 years earlier, another big country, Indonesia, invaded a much smaller one, East Timor, with the support of the United States. What followed was one of the greatest genocides of the 20th century. It is estimated that up to one-third of the Timorese population has been killed through a policy of army massacre and enforced starvation. Many of those who are left have been imprisoned and tortured by a military armed and trained by the United States. East Timor, a quiet farming nation on a mountainous island about 300 miles north of Australia, had been a Portuguese colony until 1974, when there was a democratic revolution in Portugal and the new government decided to disband its empire. Neighboring Indonesia, a military dictatorship more than 200 times East Timor's size, began attacking Timor in an effort to prevent the island nation from completing its move toward independence. On December 7, 1975, Indonesia launched a full invasion. Timorese shortwave radio, monitored by reporters in Australia, was heard putting out desperate calls for help.
A lot of people are being killed, I repeat, indiscriminately.
The night before the invasion, Secretary of State Henry Kissinger and President Ford were in the Indonesian capital of Jakarta, toasting General Suharto, the Indonesian ruler.
Our relationship involves a common concern for the right of every nation to pursue its destiny on its own independent and sovereign course. On behalf of Mrs. Ford and myself, I raise my glass and propose a toast.
João Carrascalo, the brother of the former governor of East Timor and himself a political leader now in exile, was working for the Indonesians at the time.
I arrived at Jakarta 1 hour before President Ford and Henry Kissinger landed in Jakarta. And on the same night, I was informed by Colonel Sugianto, who was a top officer in the Jakarta administration, that America had given the green light for Indonesia to invade Timor.
The United States, Suharto's main backer, supplied 90% of Indonesia's arms. The story of East Timor is a story few know about, except those who have lived through it. Six foreign journalists who were there as Indonesia attacked were executed by the Indonesian military. Australian TV correspondent Greg Shackleton sent this report the night before the frontier town where he was visiting was seized by the Indonesian troops.
Why, they ask? Are the Indonesians invading us? Why, they ask? If the Indonesians believe that Fretilin is communist, do they not send a delegation to Dili to find out? Why, they ask, are the Australians not helping us? When the Japanese invaded, they did help us. Why, they ask, are the Portuguese not helping us? We're still a Portuguese colony. Who, they ask, will pay for the terrible damage to our homes? My main answer was that Australia would not send forces here. That's impossible. However, I said we could ask that Australia raise this fighting at the United Nations. That was possible. At that, the second in charge rose to his feet, exclaimed, "Camarada journalist," shook my hand, the rest shook my hand, and we were applauded because we are Australians. That's all they want, for the United Nations to care about what is happening here.
The emotion here last night was so strong that we, all three of us, felt we should be able to reach out into the warm night air and touch it. Greg Shackleton is an unnamed village which we'll remember forever in Portuguese Timor.
And it was to be a report Australians would remember. The following day, Indonesian troops moved in and executed Shackleton and his crew. Though the government of Australia ended up siding with Indonesia, the UN Security Council denounced the invasion of East Timor and passed two resolutions, like those later passed against Iraq, calling on Indonesia to withdraw its troops without delay. But United States lobbying prevented any UN action, and as Indonesia began to execute the Timorese en masse, Washington doubled its military aid. I first arrived in East Timor in the summer of 1990, almost 16 years after the Indonesian army first came ashore. They were still occupying East Timor. I was there with journalist Alan Nairn, a correspondent for the New Yorker magazine.
Dili, the capital city, was honeycombed with army bases and torture houses. There were soldiers on the street corners, secret police watching the market stalls and the public parks. Timorese could be hauled away to the torture houses if they were found speaking to foreign tourists or listening to foreign shortwave radio. There, people would be given electroshock, beaten with iron bars, and at night, soldiers wearing hoods would roam through the neighborhoods, terrorizing the Timorese.
Journalist Alan Nairn and I returned to East Timor for a historic event. A special delegation from the United Nations and Portugal was due to visit East Timor. The Timorese hoped the visit would finally lead to UN action and enforcement of the Security Council resolutions calling on Indonesia to withdraw from East Timor.
We were told in place after place that the army had been holding neighborhood and village meetings to warn the Timorese that if they tried to speak to the UN Portuguese delegation, they and their families would be killed. And Bishop Bello, the Bishop of East Timor, told us that the threat was, we will kill your family to the seventh generation.
But despite the threats and a dramatic increase in disappearances, torture, and deaths, Timorese had prepared to speak out. They had met in secret, making banners and petitions for the delegation. When the army tried to hunt them down, many had gone into hiding and sought refuge inside churches. But under pressure from the United States, the visit of the delegation had been called off. 3 days later, with the world spotlight removed, the army stormed the Motayal, Dili's main Catholic church, and killed a young man named Sebastio Gomez, who had taken refuge there. And then came the morning of November 12th, the two-week commemoration of Sebastio's funeral. A memorial mass and procession were planned to lay flowers on Sebastio's grave. After the mass was held at the Motayal, people, young and old, came out into the street, and in a land where public speech and assembly had been forbidden for over a decade, they started chanting. The Timorese then held up banners drawn on bedsheets. They had been prepared for the delegation that never came. The banners called on Indonesia to leave East Timor and said things like, "Why the Indonesian army shoot our church?" The Timorese were facing a gauntlet of troops that stretched the length of Dili. It was the boldest act of public protest occupied Timor had ever seen.
More and more Timorese joined the procession. They came from huts and schools and offices along the way. And there was this building feeling of exhilaration as well as fear among the Timorese. And when they reached the cemetery, the crowd had swelled to maybe 5,000 people. Some went inside to lay flowers on Sebastião's grave. Most of the crowd was still outside. And then suddenly someone looked up, and we saw that marching up along the same route that the Timorese had come, came a long column of Indonesian troops, dressed in brown, holding M16s in front of them, marching in a very slow, deliberate fashion, hundreds and hundreds of troops coming straight at the Timorese.
Alan suggested we walk to the front of the crowd between the soldiers and the Timorese, because although we knew that the army had committed many massacres, we hoped that we, as foreign journalists, could serve as a shield for the Timorese. Standing with headphones on and microphone and camera out in full view, we went and stood in the middle of the road, looking straight at the approaching troops. Behind us, the crowd was hushed as some Timorese tried to turn away, but they were hemmed in by cemetery walls.
The soldiers marched straight up to us. They never broke their stride. We were enveloped by the troops, and when they got a few yards past us, within a dozen yards of the Timorese, they raised their rifles to their shoulders all at once, and they opened fire. The Timorese, in an instant, were down. It was torn apart by the bullets. The street was covered with bodies, covered with blood. And the soldiers just kept on coming. They poured in one rank after another. They leaped over the bodies of those who were down. They were aiming and shooting people in the back. I could see their limbs being torn, their bodies exploding. There was blood spurting out into the air, the pop of the bullets everywhere. And it was very organized, very systematic. The soldiers did not stop. They just kept on shooting until no one was left standing.
A group of soldiers grabbed my microphone and threw me to the ground, kicking and punching me. At that point, Alan threw himself on top of me, protecting me from further injury. The soldiers then used their rifle butts like baseball bats, beating Alan until they fractured his skull. As we sat on the ground, Alan covered in blood, a group of soldiers lined up and pointed their M16s at our heads. They had stripped us of all of our equipment. We just kept shouting, "We're from America." In the end, they decided not to execute us.
The soldiers beat us, but we actually had received privileged treatment. We were still alive. They kept on firing into the Timorese. We were able to get onto a passing civilian truck, went into hiding, but the Timorese who had been with us there on the cemetery road, most of them were dead.
Inside the cemetery walls, Max Stahl, a filmmaker on assignment with Yorkshire TV, had his video camera running.
The soldiers began at that point to encircle the entire cemetery. I saw soldiers as they gradually moved towards the middle, picking out people who were wounded or taking refuge between the tombstones. And when they got to them, they beat them and assembled them in the back of the cemetery. People were stripped to their waist. They had their thumbs tied behind their backs. And they were made to look at the ground. And if they looked up, they were immediately beaten, usually with a rifle butt.
Max Stahl was filming near a crypt in the middle of the cemetery. Some of the wounded and those too scared to run were huddled inside praying. As Stahl filmed, he buried his video cassettes in a fresh grave. Then he was arrested by the troops.
Whilst I was being interrogated, I observed these trucks driving by with more people in them. These people were clearly in a kind of paralysis of fear. They were not able to move, some of them, at least in the cemetery, and indeed even in the trucks when I saw them going by, were barely breathing. When people are that terrified, it's quite often difficult to tell if they're dead or alive.
After 9 hours in custody, Stahl went back to the cemetery under cover of night, dug up his video cassettes, and had them smuggled out of the country. Alan Nairn and I had managed to leave East Timor a few hours after the massacre. From a hospital on Guam, we reported what had happened to dozens of newspapers, radio, and television outlets around the world.
From Washington, this is the Pacifica Report for Tuesday, November 12, 1991. A massacre in East Timor. Among those injured were two journalists, including the news editor of Pacifica Station WBAI in New York.
They beat me and dragged me over and started slamming me with rifle butts and kicks and punches. And then Alan jumped on top of me, and they beat him very badly. But that was the least of what they did. They opened fire on the people, and these were truly...
When Indonesian troops opened fire on a crowd...
This is CBC Radio.
The massacre of 100 unarmed Timorese by the Indonesian military...
Imagine the first
photographs of a bloody massacre during a fight for freedom.
The CBS Evening News.
In the face of the massacre story, even Suharto's longtime allies were compelled to condemn the killings and came under public pressure to cut back their aid to Indonesia. In Australia, large crowds marched on the capital and surrounded Indonesia's local consulates. The European Parliament voted for sanctions against Indonesia, and the European Community later canceled the scheduled trade pact. There were even open protests inside Indonesia, where student demonstrators were beaten and arrested. Back in the United States, the Bush administration continued to ship weapons to Indonesia.
That's an excerpt of Massacre, the Story of East Timor, the documentary I produced with journalist Alan Nairn. East Timor, or Timor-Leste, would vote for its freedom in a UN referendum in 1999 and become an independent nation in 2002, one of the newest nations in the world. The video from inside the cemetery was filmed by Max Stahl, the award-winning filmmaker who died several weeks ago at the age of 66. To see the whole thing, go to Democracy Now! .org. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe.
Is black liberation possible in the United States? Not as the United States is currently configured. These are problems that we can't vote our way in or out of. These are not problems that are on the ballot. We don't get to vote on the massive redistribution of wealth and resources in this country. It really requires a different society where there's the democratic input of all of us about what our society should be and what it should look like. That can't happen in the way that this country exists now. To that extent, what I'm talking about is really a revolutionary transformation of the United States.
That's Kianga Yamata Taylor, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Kianga Yamata Taylor on black liberation. The widespread protests in the wake of the murders of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor marked a new chapter in the struggle for black liberation. What would constitute black liberation? Kianga Yamata Taylor says, it's about self-determination. Can we make decisions free of economic coercion? Can we make decisions that are truly free? That, to me, is what liberation would be. She continues, I know that it's not something that black people can achieve alone. Black liberation is bound up with human liberation. On a purely mathematical basis, black people drift between 13 and 14% of the population. We can't get free alone. So this is also about really trying to examine the connections between the subjugation of black people and how that relates to a wider web of subjugation of other people. And that includes white people, too. Our guest today is Kianga Yamata Taylor. She writes and speaks on black politics, social movements, and racial inequality. She's a professor of African American studies at Princeton. Her articles appear in The New Yorker, The Nation, The Guardian, and Jacobin. She's the author of Race for Profit, How We Get Free, and the award-winning From Hashtag Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation. Kianga Yamata Taylor was in Philadelphia in mid-July. The interviewer was Michelle Alexander, Ohio State University professor and author of the bestseller The New Jim Crow. She poses the first question.
One of the themes that's most striking in your book is that it's impossible to understand black politics and activism in America today, particularly with respect to the Obama era, without understanding the nature of the class divide that exists within black communities. You know, in mainstream discourse, particularly within the mainstream media, when class is discussed explicitly, it's usually in the context of explaining or defending the angry white men who voted for Trump or the challenges the Democratic Party has faced in trying to appeal to less educated working class whites. But a key insight in your book is that class divisions are driving race politics. We're driving those protests to a large degree. And you write that black economic elites have a vested interest in the notion of colorblindness and the myth that the US is basically a meritocracy and the notion that the election of Barack Obama shows that we have overcome or are overcoming. I wonder if you could say a little bit more about the role of class in black politics and activism and how the gap between the rich and poor is even more pronounced among blacks than whites and why that matters in thinking about protest and politics then and today.
Yeah, absolutely. And the events in Ferguson, I mean, there are many events that crystallize this, but when you think about Ferguson and the way that, for example, the Congressional Black Caucus mobilized itself to go to Ferguson, and their main objective was voter registration, right? That this is, we got to get people registered and we have to vote, and that's the most important thing. And, you know, people try to characterize the clash and the conflict between young activists who were on the street